You're listening to the Screaming Pods Network.
I'd written The Breakfast Club, and after this experience, I thought, well, I want to direct now. So, in my sort of dumb, uninformed, Chicago northern suburb, sitting in a bedroom converted to an office, thinking, okay, here's show business. And I figured that if I wrote something that was real cheap, that I could somehow scare up the money to do it, and that I would do it. It'd be real easy, which is all I would have with me, five actors in one room. But gotta be so easy, because all I have to do is deal with performance, which I like. And when I was in advertising, I did a lot of stuff, produced a lot of commercials and all that stuff, which is mainly dealing with the actors, actors and food. Movies about food are just not very good. So I had this idea to do five kids in detention.
Wake up. Wake her up. This ain't no rest home. Welcome to another episode of Just the Discs. My name is Brian Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. My lovely and talented and intelligent wife is joining me.
You can't keep a straight face.
You cracked up before I even finished complimenting you. For this episode, we are talking about two classics, and they are both from the Criterion Collection. First, we're going to talk about The Breakfast Club, and then we're going to talk about Night of the Living Dead. I know that those don't sound like they go together, but... They're just kind of like both classics in their own right, so I thought it might be fun to talk about both. And they both come out recently, so.
Their parents expect them to make good.
Our old school is going to give a scholarship to a discipline case.
Their school expects them to be bad.
Let's find out how tough you are.
Does Barry Manilow know that you raid his wardrobe?
Nobody expects them to become friends.
You want to talk?
Go away.
But that's just what they're going to do.
Why are you being so nice to me?
You're letting me?
The Breakfast Club. Rated R. Sneak preview February 8th and 9th at select theaters.
So, Lisa, my darling, what is it about The Breakfast Club that makes the movie endure in your mind? We both talked about how we've incorporated parts of its dialogue into our vernacular, for lack of a better word, and I don't even really understand why that is. What do you think about the movie?
Well, first of all, high school is an impressionable time for people, right? And I feel like, think of all the shows like Freaks and Geeks and Stranger Things, if you want to get to more modern times, and the whole high school being a huge...
Microcosm?
Not the word I was going to use, but sure. No, just I just mean like an important piece of developmental time. And I think times where people, I know for me... Obviously, I'm a sucker for high school movies or shows even. And I think it's just because sometimes reliving times that maybe when you're not in the pain and you can see it in a different perspective and kind of imagine what if and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's a sense of whew, I got out of that alive. Now it's much easier to look back.
Except for all the dreams of horror. I mean, oh, no, I didn't say that.
Well, so I'm pretty sure I mentioned it on the show, or maybe not. You are a high school teacher. And
that I am.
We realized that you've been teaching.
Oh, stop.
For,
longer than it takes for someone to have been born and gone to high school.
Well, but we realized that you've been teaching for longer than Mr. Vernon in the movie.
Ouch.
I think. Because he says 22 years or something, and you're a little longer than that.
I thought I was just under. I can't remember.
Okay, now. Well, you're right around Mr. Vernon time.
Yes,
but I don't feel you're nearly as cynical as him. But do you think that has something to do with why you like high school movies? Is that you live it every day, kind of?
No, I think I enjoy them before I was a high school teacher when I taught the youngins, but...
Has the high school experience made you less or more interested? I feel like you're definitely not any less interested since I've known you.
No, I don't think it's actually, I know that sounds odd and impossible, but I don't know if it's actually affected me in that way. Because I've always really loved watching movies during that, age range time,
Well, okay, let me ask you this. As a high school teacher, do you think that The Breakfast Club is still relevant. Well, I mean, okay, I think, yes, we can both agree it is relevant, but in terms of the stereotypes that it perpetuates, the, you know, brain, athlete, basket case, princess, criminal, all those categories, do you feel like those still exist in your school today, or are they blurred and different?
It's interesting. I think the one that I think the most I don't see as much now is like princess.
Claire?
Claire, it's a family name.
Oh, it's a fat girl's name.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm not fat.
Well, not at present, but I could see you really pushing maximum density. You see, I'm not sure if you know this, but there are two kinds of fat people. There's fat people that were born to be fat, and there's fat people that were once thin, but they became fat. So when you look at them, you can sort of see that thin person inside. You see, you're going to get married, you're going to squeeze out a few puppies, and then... oh, obscene finger gestures from such a pristine girl.
I'm not that pristine.
I don't think that's so much of a thing. I feel I could force someone into that category, I guess, if I think of my students. But for the most part, I don't see that as much. I do see different versions of it, obviously, morphed over time. But I still think there are the jocks, and there are the geeky kids, and there are the, you know, the bad kids, and there are the weird kids. But princess, I don't see as much.
I was just thinking about The Breakfast Club in relation to some more recent high school movies, like, say, 21 Jump Street, and how that movie really goes right at the idea of what is a nerd, and are nerds still ostracized, or in the case of that movie, they're seen as like
the cool kids.
Yeah, kind of like.
Is that your car?
Yeah.
What's that thing get? 10 miles to the gallon?
No, try like 7. What about you?
Biodiesel, dog.
It smells like egg rolls.
Yeah, it does. Runs on leftover fry oil from Hunan Palace. But we try to ride bikes when we can, global crisis and whatnot.
Whatever, man. I don't care about anything.
Oh, you don't care about the environment? It's kind of fucked up, man.
Hey, will y'all shut the hell up? I'm trying to study.
Look at him. He's trying. He's actually trying. What a nerd. Look at the nerd. Nerd. Look at him. Look at the nerd.
What are you calling a nerd, man?
I'm sorry, what?
Oh! Shit, dude. Hey, are you okay, man? Hey, what the hell? Are you serious?
I'll turn that gay-ass music off.
You punch me because I'm gay?
What? No. Oh, come on.
That's not cool, man.
That is really insensitive.
I didn't punch him because he's gay. I punched him, and then he's happened to turn out to be gay afterwards.
I was gay when you punched me!
In a weird way, it might have been homophobic not to punch you just because you were gay.
Right.
I think that I wouldn't ever compare personally 21 Jump Street to The Breakfast Club, because I feel like 21 Jump Street is purposefully a mockery of everything. And I don't think that The Breakfast Club is at all trying to be a mockery of anything.
I don't know if 21 Jump Street is a mockery. What's the difference between a mockery and an homage and a, you know, like, I feel like it's definitely
the difference between a mockery and an homage are night and day.
I know. That's why I'm saying I think it's more of an homage than a mockery, personally. 21 Jump Street I'm talking about. I feel like it's an homage to other high school movies. I feel like it is trying to examine present day nerds are not nerds anymore. And that's what I was trying to get at with that line of questioning, is if you see nerdy kids ostracized, or are there nerdy kids?
See, that's the thing. There's a difference between cool kids who are nerdy because that's a cool thing versus true nerdy kids who very different and still ostracized.
Nobody wears pocket protectors or anything anymore, right?
No, but there are like the computer kids who know all the stuff about tech and aren't like the created media version of you know, like the cool techie kid, you know. There still are nerdy kids.
Yeah.
That don't get love.
I'm sure that's true.
I guess the love they deserve. How about
that? I guess I just feel like there's been like sort of a turnabout in terms of nerdiness, and that there is like wave your geek flag kind of.
No, I see what you're saying, but I think that there's also like a group of kids who, I guess, maybe if you think of The Breakfast Club, maybe more in terms of closer to Ally Sheedy in terms of weirdness, but yet they're still cool and they're okay with their weirdness. So they're like, I'm weird and I'm proud.
You want to know what I did to get in here? Nothing. I didn't have anything better to do. You're laughing at me.
No!
Yeah, you are.
Whereas there's also the jockey kids who are still, not all of them, because I'm not saying all jocks are like this, right? But the stereotypical jockey kid who doesn't even have the IQ or the emotional intelligence, whatever you want to call it, to recognize that those nerdy kids are important, you know, or are interesting or can teach them a lot, or maybe their boss one day.
So the jocks kind of are still the jocks, is what you're saying, in a lot of ways.
I mean, yes and no. So there are a small group of people who are the jocks and they're just like, huh, what? And stuff like that. I can think of one right now, no names.
Yeah.
Then there's ones that are super intelligent and super together, but they also are trying to be well-rounded for their college application and have 4 years of that sport and all of this and all of that. So I feel like there's a huge gamut. And also just at my school, which I always like to say that when I was in high school, I think I was, I don't know, living under a rock. Maybe I still am. But I feel like there weren't that many kids into sports. I feel like at my school and where I teach now, it feels like, I want to say like huge percentage, like maybe 70% wow. maybe of the kids are in some sort of athletic endeavor.
Yeah. Well, now, you know, I shouldn't come down so hard on the Breakfast Club as enforcing those stereotypes, because obviously the final letter that Brian Johnson writes is very much like, we discovered we are all these things and that we came in with these preconceived notions of what we all were. And in fact, that's not true. So,
and also the idea that you have to work to fit into this stereotype too, right? That you're in this box. And if you go out of it, it's not a box that others create for you, but sometimes a box that you agree to being a part of. And it's hard to stay in that group because you have to fit that mold in order to stay in. So for instance, you know, the princess, she likes being a princess and she doesn't like being called a princess per se, but she likes all the things that come with it. But she also wants to be able to be nice to people and not be stuck up and not be seen as, you know, this person on a pedestal. But she can't do that because remember that one part where she goes,
she loses
why are
it.
You being, no, why are you being so nice to me? Ali Sheedy says to her, and she goes, because you're letting me. And I think of those moments where it's not that she's like a bitchy person. It's that people just assume she is. So sometimes
she feels like it's expected.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, that is interesting. It definitely is kind of a, what is expected of me? What is my social role kind of thing?
Do you want the truth?
Yeah, I want the truth.
I don't think so. With all of us or just John? With all of you?
That's a real nice attitude, Claire.
Oh, be honest, Andy. If Brian came walking up to you in the hall on Monday, what would you do? I mean, picture this, you're there with all the sports. I know exactly what you'd do. You'd say hi to him, and when he left, you'd cut him all up so your friends wouldn't think that you really liked him.
No way.
Okay. What if I came up to you? The same exact thing.
You are a bitch!
Why? Because I'm telling the truth? That makes me a bitch?
No. Because you know how shitty that is to do to someone. And you don't got the balls to stand up to your friends and tell them that you're going to like who you want to like.
Okay, what about you, you hypocrite? Why don't you take Allison to one of your heavy metal vomit parties? Or take Brian out to the parking lot at lunch and get high? Or what about Andy, for that matter? What about me? What would your friends say if we were walking down the hall together? They'd laugh their asses off, and you'd probably tell them that you were doing it with me so they'd forgive you for being seen with me.
Don't you ever talk about my friends. You don't know any of my friends, you don't look at any of my friends, and you certainly wouldn't condescend to speak to any of my friends, so you just stick to the things that you know. Shopping, nail polish, your father's BMW, and your poor, rich, drunk mother in the Caribbean.
Shut up!
And as far as being concerned about what's going to happen when you and I walk down the hallways of school, you can forget it, because it's never going to happen. Just bury your head in the sand and wait for your fucking prom.
I hate you.
Yeah? Good.
Okay, then I assume Allison and I are better people than you guys, huh? Us weirdos. Would you do that to me?
I don't have any friends.
Well, if you did.
No. I don't think the kind of friends I'd have would mind.
I just want to tell each of you that I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't, and I will not. Because I think that's real shitty.
Your friends wouldn't mind because they look up to us.
You're so conceited, Clint. You're so conceited. You're like full of yourself. Why are you like that?
I'm not saying that to be conceited. I hate it. I hate having to go along with everything my friends say.
Well, then why do you do it?
I don't know. I don't... You don't understand. You don't... You're not friends with the same kind of people that Annie and I are friends with. You know, you just don't understand the pressure that they can put on you.
I don't understand what? You think I don't understand pressure, Claire? Well, fuck you! Fuck you!
Yeah, there's just so many lines, though. I was realizing some of my favorite lines come from Vernon, surprisingly, and which is weird. And I think it was always the case, but I don't know if it's something where I've gotten older and that. Like, just don't mess with the bull, you get the horns. You know, I expect more from a varsity letterman. That thing he says in the hallway, hugga dugga, I don't know what that means. I tried to look it up. It's like some kind of gibberish, but that sometimes I find myself saying to myself for no reason at all, not out loud so that I can be like, hey, I'm quoting The Breakfast Club, but just literally like it's a thing that I say to myself when I'm alone. It's very strange. What are some of the things that you identify with the lines?
More Jed Nelson's comments for sure. Yeah. his definitely stick in my head more than anybody else.
Sporto?
What?
You get along with your parents?
Well, if I say yes, I'm an idiot, right?
You're an idiot anyway. But if you say you get along with your parents, well, you're a liar too.
Second would probably be, I guess, Molly Ringwald, but... Definitely Judd Nelson would be the ones that stick for sure.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely one of the best, that's for sure. Let me just run down, because I want to talk about the deleted scenes. The special features on this Criterion Blu-ray, I do love that this is on Criterion. It just says something about our generation, I think. Just like, this is now a classic movie. I mean, it kind of always has been for a while, it feels like, but I just never thought I'd see the day when it would be recognized in this nice packaging and with the Criterion. I don't know. So, special features, 4K digital restoration with uncompressed binaural soundtrack, audio commentary from 2008 featuring Anthony Michael Hall and Judd Nelson, new interviews with actors Molly Ringwald and Ally Sheedy, new video essay featuring director John Hughes' production notes read by Judd Nelson.
Walk-ins. Molly. Still pissed. Bored. Disbelief. Looks around at the place, curls her lips, sighs, sits down at the first seat. Brian, still feels shame, fear, nerves. Andy, angry, empty, vacant, waves to Claire, little smile. John, bold, in control, doesn't give a shit, knocks something off the counter, lots of reactions from the others, moves Brian from his seat. Allison, walks in with head bowed, slows but doesn't stop, continues around behind the sculpture to her seat.
Documentary from 2008 featuring interviews with the cast and crew that we definitely watched a good portion of.
Hughes wrote a great script. It's not like he's precious about each word. He's precious about his own sense of truth.
I think he said that he had written Breakfast Club a long, long, long time before. And he had it in the drawer or something.
You know, in the industry, it's called a Talking Heads movie, where people, you know, there formerly had been films like My Dinner with Andre or... You know, maybe European films where it's so simplified. But with that, it was really like filming a play.
John said something like that he wrote the first draft in a weekend. And both Emilio and I, it was almost simultaneously. I was like, first draft, okay, how many drafts do you have? And Hughes said, well, I got a few. Why? And Emilio and I were like, can we read them? This is during the rehearsal process. So he's like, sure, hey. So we read them. I was like, John, so how about if we put this? He was like, sure, let's try it.
50 minutes of never-before-seen deleted and extended scenes. That I definitely want to talk about in a second. Rare promotional and archival interviews, excerpt from a 1985 AFI seminar with John Hughes.
I mean, to me, the actor's the most important thing on the set. You know, it really starts with the actor. I mean, you protect the script, you know, through pre-production, through production. The script and the actors are like, you know, sacred. And I give them a lot of freedom. I like their ideas. I like their input. You know, they're all. If you don't ask them for something, you're not going to get anything. And you know, it's very easy for me to say no. What I like to do in rehearsals is let them have, you know, say anything they want, challenge me, confront me, and then once we're shooting, we know pretty much what we want to do. And if something comes up, if somebody has an idea and they want to try it, it's really easy for me to say, I don't think that's going to work. But I like the actor to be the final, to determine ultimately what the character is going to be. And I'm like the Supreme Court, you know? I mean, I can come in and say, no, that isn't right.
1999 radio interview with Hughes, segment from 1985 episode of NBC's Today featuring the film's cast. I always like those kind of things when it gives you the context of the period of the actors.
You play a hood when you in fact went to one of the finest prep schools in the country in real life. How did you go back and recall what life as a hood in a public high school might be like?
Well, I have to draw on my imagination a great deal. But in addition to that, we rehearsed outside of Chicago. And I went to an actual high school in the area for about a week and attended classes and was a quiet corner observer.
Looking like Judd or like John?
Like John.
With the hair and...
Yes, with the hair and the clothes so that the kids in the school would treat me the way that they would treat a character like John.
Which is to say how?
With a great deal of condescension.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great to get the sense of oppression that I think runs rampant mm-hmm. in public high schools. Deans in the hallways, hall monitors, principals telling you what to do every second.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
You know, they just feel so unaware of the thing that they're in because it's literally just coming out and they have no context for what it's going to become and just shows like a snapshot of where they are at that time. Audio interview with Ringwald from a 2014 episode of This American Life and an essay by critic David Camp. Now, we watched pretty much all the deleted scenes and there was some interesting stuff there, although not necessarily stuff I felt like we felt like should be in the movie. Right? I mean, there was that bathroom scene with the girls. Mm-hmm. Was interesting to see. I mean, especially when you know a movie as well as we do, to see this suddenly this other scene, you're like, what? What is this about? But then you do see why, like, oh, maybe it wasn't necessary. But I think the biggest one that stood out to me was a deleted scene with the janitor, Carl, where, you know, there obviously is, I mean, it's an extended version of that scene that we see in the movie. It's much different, though, because it gives Carl's backstory. And how he basically, you know, when he says, you know, Andrew wants to pursue a career in the custodial arts, he goes into like this whole thing about like how he got his girlfriend pregnant. And he's like, you live with your parents for 8 years and you keep fucking up and you get busted for dealing hash and you keep fucking up and you keep fucking up. And it's like, it just gives you this weird sympathy for him that, not that I didn't have sympathy before, but I suddenly just feel bad for him. And then it goes from that into him basically going down the line and saying like what he thinks each of them is going to be, you know, when they grow up. And it's pretty derogatory. It's pretty like straight ahead, like this is how you're going to be a fuck up and this is how you're going to be. And it's almost like more mean-spirited and
yeah.
it just didn't work for me. I guess obviously because I'm used to the scene another way. I always loved how Carl was like, you see me as some untouchable serf. Peon. I love that he uses the word surf. That immediately gave him credibility for me because I'm like, oh, that's not a word that everybody knows. That's kind of a 50 cent word.
Even peon.
And peon too. Yeah, no, definitely. But the way that he leaves the scene and says, you know, that clock's 20 minutes fast and Judd Nelson smiles and it's this whole like, yeah, we don't give him enough credit kind of thing. The smile at the end of the scene after he just took everybody down, including Bender, didn't play right for me. I was just like, oh, that doesn't feel the same. I mean, I guess maybe a guy like John Bender would enjoy that, but I didn't really get it. It didn't really make sense to me. So anyway, that was a big one. And then we got to see Ally Sheedy's character use the switchblade she stole earlier to break into a locker when she's going on the drink run with Andrew, which was a little weird. There's just a lot of stuff where I'm just like, nope, didn't really need it, you know?
Yeah, some of them were almost like, I'm glad it wasn't in there because it would have not added to the story.
It almost like took away from some of the characters. Yeah. Like there's the conversation between Bender and Claire. It's like, it's somewhere between the scene where Brian and Bender and Claire are hanging out talking and then the other kids come back from the drinks.
Like when they're getting high? No, it's not later when they're getting high? No.
Maybe, I think it's after. Maybe it's after they got high. That's the other thing is I couldn't tell where these scenes fit, but it's this whole scene where she's looking at some books and he slides some books over.
Oh, right.
And looks through the bookshelf and starts flirting with her more, which I did kind of like that they set up the relationship of Bender and Claire a little bit more so that ending feels a little more earned. Because that was one of my bigger issues with them. Not a big issue, but an issue where I'm like, I don't really see where they really fell for each other, you know? And I don't know. So that made it feel a little better, that scene. And then there was a scene where Brian does the imitation of his home life, like after Bender. And that felt weird too. Like that was kind of like sad and creepy, and not creepy, but just like, oh, everybody's home life really sucks. And I get it, but for some reason, I just liked it when they made fun of him and we were just left to think that his home life was not that bad. Although we do get a weird impression of his mom when she drops him off.
I was just thinking about how we disagree about the ending.
What
it means. Remember, we had this discussion about how you think that Claire and Bender end up together, and I disagree. I don't think that's
you've
what
never
I was
thought that
to
they
say.
Ended up together.
No, okay. No.
See, I don't know. I mean, there's a deleted scene that leads me to believe that you might be more right. There's an extended segment when they say goodbye to each other that feels like more final. But his whole like celebratory fist pump, like that just doesn't feel right to me. If they like. Yeah, she didn't go for me. Like, what? Like, how does that, you know what I mean? Like, what's the victory?
Maybe now they're friends, or maybe they understand each other. But I feel like giving him the earring, it's almost like something that you do to someone.
A parting gift?
Yeah, sort of, not a parting gift. I think that's a little too much. But like, sort of like, I'll be with you. This is something to remember me by. But yeah, we're not going to be together.
So it kind of goes back to what she said when Brian asked them, like, what are you guys going to treat me like come Monday?
Well, no, in that case, I think that they will greet each other in the hall. Yeah. I just don't think that her and him are dating in any way. Huh. No.
I still have always felt like when he says, you know, wouldn't I be excellent in that capacity, you know, in terms of her parents, I really felt like she was in a position to be like, yeah, actually, you kind of are.
Wouldn't that be using him then? And wouldn't that be the
But isn't he kind of saying, like, I'm actually okay with that in that scene? I kind of felt like he was. Like, I'm okay with trying that out, you know? I don't know. I feel like he's trying to sell himself to her in a way that I've always felt really gave that character a sensitivity that I didn't feel like he had before. Like, he's really let his guard down. He's, like, offering himself up to her and saying, use me. Like you're saying, I think. So I don't know. I guess you can interpret it either way. You really can. But I always thought the fist pump felt like a more celebratory, like, that was a good day and I met a new girl kind of thing. But maybe I've been brainwashed.
I don't know. Or maybe it was just a day where he met people and it wasn't like an awful day like he has at home.
Yeah. No, I guess. I mean, certainly a better Saturday than he's had prior.
Yeah. Maybe there's other people to join in with him. Maybe he doesn't get as much company in detention.
Yeah. No, it's true. I'm sure it was better. There were a couple more deleted scenes. Claire tells her story of ditching school to go shopping, which we both agreed was really lame.
That was bad.
Completely unnecessary. Just makes her seem way more vapid. And
yeah, didn't.
I felt like that was perfectly conveyed with the scenes that are in the movie to a point, you know?
You didn't even need to know the details. She already said why. Why do I need to know all the details? Unnecessary.
Yeah. I mean, I love economic storytelling. So when her dad says, ditching in school to go shopping does not make you a defective, I've got it. I don't need any more. And I much prefer like one line expositional than like longer scenes. You know, I don't know. I just think it's easier to do it that way. Show it, don't tell it for the most part. Or if you tell it in a short way, you know. And I think Brian tells an extended version of how he got there, which I also didn't need. I felt like the way that it is in the movie is good. So I don't know. I've always been excited about the idea of this like 2 hour plus cut of this movie, but in
now you know why you don't have it.
Yeah, I mean, in actuality, it's well worth watching those scenes just to give this outside universe context, but I still love the movie the way it is. So that's about it for Breakfast Club. The other classic we're going to discuss is George A. Romero's Night of the Living Dead.
Zombies cannot run. I say this definitively as the grandfather or the godfather of zombies. Zombies cannot run. So anyone who has a zombie running, don't listen to that person. Their ankles would snap. I mean, you know, what did they do? Go and join a spa the moment they rose from the dead? Give me a break. They're dead.
I'm just going to read the back of it. Shot outside of Pittsburgh on a shoestring budget by a band of filmmakers determined to make their mark, Night of the Living Dead, directed by horror master George A. Romero, is a great story of independent cinema. A midnight hit turned box office smash that became one of the most influential films of all time. A deceptively simple tale of a group of strangers trapped in a farmhouse who find themselves fending off a horde of recently dead flesh-eating ghouls.
Don't worry about him, I can handle them.
Probably be a lot more of them as soon as they find out about us.
truck is out of gas. This pump out here is locked. Is there a key? We can try to get out here if we can get some gas. Is there a key? I suppose you've tried this. Do you live here? Jesus. We've got to get out of here. We have to get to where there's some other people. Maybe we better take some food. I'll see if I can find some food.
Romero's claustrophobic vision of a late 1960s America literally tearing itself apart rewrote the rules of the horror genre, combined gruesome gore with acute social commentary, and quietly broke ground by casting a black actor, Dwayne Jones, in its lead role. Stark, haunting, and more relevant than ever, Night of the Living Dead is back. I just thought about both films are kind of self-contained in one location, so at least they have that connective tissue.
No pun intended.
No. So what were your memories of this movie? Like, did you see it? I feel like for me, it's one that is notorious because it's a classic, but also because, and I don't know if you know this story, but basically when they were doing the final prints, they forgot to put the trademark on the logo or whatever, on the title card or the end card. I can't remember. Somebody at a lab, I think, screwed up, and basically then anybody could run off a print. And, you know, I think he's since found a way to recoup some. Obviously, he's passed away, but he didn't see a ton of that money because of some, like, basically not a clerical mistake, but like a lab mistake. It's just one of those horrible...
How can that even be... See, that would never happen today.
No, it wouldn't, but it's also about independent filmmaking and, you know, how things get missed. And, you know, if a major studio's behind it, they're not going to let something like that happen. But what I was going to say is that because of that mistake...
No, but you have all the stuff, all the proof that it's yours. That's just ridiculous.
There's some kind of... Well, it's just nothing can stop anybody from... I mean, I think he made some money, but... Nothing can stop anybody from making their own copy, dupe of a print, and taking it and showing it somewhere because that trademark wasn't there. I don't know the specifics of how that works, but I know that that's true. Another thing that happened because of that is that it's often the movie that you see playing on TVs in movies because it was a public domain film and anybody could, they didn't have to pay for licensing.
That's so funny. I have seen that on TV in a lot of movies.
Yeah, right. So I think that's interesting because it's a double-edged sword. A, more people know of it because they're like, oh, they're watching Night of the Living Dead. But B, he wasn't getting paid for a lot of that usage, which is sad. Which is another reason this new Criterion Blu-ray is so neat because they've, you know, it's sad that a movie...
Is the money going to his
estate? I think they've since corrected it, but I want to say for a while there was no way for him to stop a lot of that stuff. And for a long time you could get it on these really cheap DVDs because somebody was able to just find a print and put out this crappy version. So there was never an incentive for people to put out a good version because everybody would be like, oh, well, I'll just buy this crappy for, you know, $2 versus...
But as you noted, this version looks pretty beautiful.
It does. And so it's really nice that Criterion picked it up and did this beautiful transfer. I've never seen it look this good. And hopefully people will go, okay, this is the version I need to own. But anyway, so you growing up, did you ever watch it? Did you ever see it on TV? What was your experience with it?
I don't remember ever seeing this growing up, no. I remember hearing about it a lot, and I remember all the movies based on it, but I did not see it growing up.
So, I mean, it's obviously notorious for being an early zombie film. I mean, there are certainly films with zombies in them, but not the zombies that I think we've come to know as zombies. Mm-hmm. The Walking Dead... Mm-hmm. Obviously takes a lot of cues from it, you know. It's so interesting, again, that very simple setup. People trapped in a house. It always seems like zombie movies end up with people barricading themselves somewhere. Like, it's really kind of truthful in a way. It's like, what could you do if you were really in it? Well,
run fast.
Run, try and get away, try and get in a vehicle, drive as fast as you can, you know, get in a helicopter if you're in Dawn of the Dead or whatever. But
it runs out of gas.
Yeah, well, any vehicle runs out of gas. So I guess there's the idea of like just trying to get a foothold somewhere. And
well, I guess it all depends on how many there are, right?
Yeah.
Because at the end, when they're all taking everybody, you know, going there. And I don't know, are we not doing spoilers? Everybody's seen this already?
Well, I mean, we can refer to the ending. I mean, the ending obviously is pretty famous. If you haven't seen Night of the Living Dead, definitely watch it. You'll see another reason why the movie resonates beyond the casting of a black actor as the lead, which I think Romero just said he didn't do any of that purposefully. It was just like he gave the best
performance
audition. Yeah, he was just like, he was the guy, and he's great in it. He's really great. But it wasn't some sociopolitical statement on his part necessarily. He just was open to it.
Dwayne Jones, the actor who played Ben, was very concerned and almost the only one who was concerned about his being African-American. We were going, hey, come on, man, it's 1968. This is, we're all past all of that. Little did we know, right? When we made the first print of that, of the movie, and we were driving it to New York to show it to potential distributors, we heard driving in the car, one of the producers, Russ Streiner, and I heard the news on the radio that Martin Luther King had been assassinated. Now all of a sudden it was a black film. It became a black film. Even though when Jack Russo and I wrote the script, the character in the script, we assumed him to be white. When Dwayne agreed to play the role, we didn't change the script. The same things would have happened to him if the actor had been white. The fact that these redneck posse guys shot him, that became racial instead of just a mistaken identity, which is really what we intended. Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons that people believe to this day that it's important. And in a certain way, it was a mistake.
But yeah, so that ending definitely sticks with, but yet, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying that when there's all the shooting, it doesn't seem like the zombies have, or the, they don't, they call them ghouls, not zombies, but whatever they are, that these creatures that we've come to refer to or know as zombies don't seem to be outnumbering the living, at least in this area that we see.
Yeah.
And so because of that, I think it's interesting how they all chose to like be in there. But I guess, you know, hey, it's easy to judge when you're not in the situation, right? You know, well, things are coming at you and this is the only place to hide and you don't know how many there are out there. Hey, yeah, that's a good idea. So
well,
I mean, guess it makes sense.
I mean, we could go back to Breakfast Club too about in with regards to this in terms of like social media and awareness and 24-hour news cycles and all these things that didn't exist when both of these movies came out for the most part definitely changes how you react to things, you know, and how things impact you. I've just always found the zombie genre to be interesting in that it was one of the first ones that gave me this sense of like hopelessness where you're just like, I mean, in the case of the end of Night of the Living Dead, they seem to have gotten an outbreak under control, but then there is some indication that it's not under control. But just the idea that like you are outnumbered and you cannot win and how that works as both literal and allegorical, you know, in terms of what horror can do and how it can make you feel. There's something about it. I feel like you're a big zombie, like you've watched way more of The Walking Dead than I have. I've given up on that show long ago. And I'm not saying it's not a good show.
Way
it's just,
more. I've watched it all.
Yes, sorry.
Waiting for the rest to come out.
Yes, yes.
As we speak, it's about to come out.
She and my son have fully invested in the show and I have checked out a long time ago. I just can't deal with that. Maybe it's that sense of hopelessness and that sense of sadness that comes with this. Like, I just can't deal with it on a in a TV show. I don't know. That just doesn't. But I get how it could be addictive. You know, what is it about zombie stuff that draws you in?
I don't know if it's just zombie stuff in general, but why is it? That's a really good question. I don't know. I guess just the idea of trying to find a way of survival, right? Like, how will you survive? What will you do if you're faced with no choice but to find a way to survive? And how would you do it? And what would you do? And I remember, I was just thinking about Hawthorne when he was younger, how he would sleep with toy guns under his bed and he'd say, if zombies came to life, then so would his guns. And he had like escape plans. And
you never told me that.
You know? Oh, yeah. And he had escape plans and this idea that...
Didn't
like,
you think zombies were real for a while? I mean, like, look it up and...
Oh, I don't know. But there were times, like, I so many times I thought of, oh, I could totally freak the crap out of him, but I would die. I know I would die because he would act as if it were real and I would be dead.
What? You know? He didn't have real firearms. It's not like he was going to kill you.
No, but he would probably with the fake gun smash someone down because he...
Smashed on his own mother.
If I pretended like I was a zombie, I don't know, maybe.
Oh my God.
Seriously, he was really...
I remember he used to have more of a zombie paranoia than he does now.
Well, now he really likes it and he came to like it. But I remember when he would play, what's that video game? Call of Duty. And there was the World War II, the Nazi zombies.
Yeah.
And he would play that and he couldn't play alone. And he'd have to play it with a friend. And then eventually he'd play, but then he'd start to get freaked out and he'd be, you know... came to love them. He would read the comics and
I remember getting him the Walking Dead comics before, maybe after the show just started.
He loved that. And then little by little, I think it's sort of like you learn to overcome your fear, and then the thing you feared you're drawn to in this weird way.
I mean, I think that's what horror is all about.
Right.
And it's about the idea of being frightened, but then realizing that there's nothing really to be scared of, at least in the context of what the movie's about. And that you can then walk away from that feeling a new, I don't want to get too carried away, but like a new lease on life. But just sort of this idea that you can be like, thank goodness that's not real. And I was able to sort of cathartically experience that and then walk away and think about how good my life is. I don't know. It's there's something about that part of horror that I've always been amused by. And that Raven's starting to respond to a little bit too, which is interesting.
Yeah, I know it's funny how, but I was the same way when I was young. I was afraid of, you know, even the commercials would scare me.
What was it? It was Magic?
To be fair, in the 70s, the commercials were a lot scarier, I feel like.
Very much. So it was Rosemary's Baby and Magic, right? Those two commercials?
Magic. Abracadabra, I sit on his knee. Presto, change-o, and now he is me. Hocus pocus, we take her to bed. Magic is free. We're dead.
Josephine Levine presents Magic, a terrifying love story starring Anthony Hopkins, Anne Margaret, and Burgess Meredith. Rated R.
There was more. I feel I can't remember them all. There was a lot. There were just so many that were creepy. And I just remember even I still have this vision of Rosemary's Baby on the TV and being down. We had this long kind of, or it felt like a long hallway in the apartment that I grew up in. And just like going out,
hallways are inherently
down
creepy.
The hallway, seeing the from the TV, seeing, you know, like,
oh, so you're looking down the hall and you saw that on TV.
Yeah.
Paramount Pictures presents Mia Farrow in a William Castle production, Rosemary's Baby, co-starring John Cassavetes, Ruth Gordon, Sidney Blackmer, Morris Evans, and Ralph Bellamy. Written for the screen and directed by Roman Polanski. From the best-selling novel by Ira Levin. Suggested for mature audiences.
Just like visions
That's
of that.
Creepier.
And of course, you know how when your little things seem bigger, and then also just like when you're nervous or scared, it can like elongate the hallway. So it just felt like, oh, so far down and I had to get to it. I don't know.
Well, I mean, there is something about the 70s and how much more protective we've gotten of our children, which is good and bad, I think. But I feel like those TV commercials are a reflection of like, well, A, it's sort of a lack of awareness of what could be traumatizing and how that could affect somebody well into their later life.
It's funny that you talk about that, because like you think about society and how society changes over time, and the things that we start to eradicate from public ends up being more prevalent in society. So for instance, like probably back in the day in like the 1800s or something, like when women would cover up all the way, I'm sure there was a lot more like infidelity then than now. And like the idea of like, okay, we protect kids from all of this and all of that, but we have such a violent world now. And it's just interesting how that works.
Yeah.
Sorry, getting off topic.
No. It's just something I definitely think about when I think about the difference in society pre and post internet, pre and post cell phones, all these things that have changed. But just a general sort of sense of like, we have to be really aware of traumatizing our children, and maybe you and I are guilty of traumatizing ours a little
Some
bit.
Some people, the gate.
Yeah, Raven will not let go of the gate. I showed her the gate when she was too young, and I honestly don't think it would scare her that much now.
Well, not anymore. I don't think it would scare her. She's seen probably much worse, but at the time, yeah. And she likes to call back to that all the time.
Boy, almost every week, I feel like she brings it up.
But she did.
Which makes me feel bad.
I mean, see it again though. Recently, she said she's more mature. Was her thing. I'm mature now.
Yeah,
it won't scare me.
Well, we should watch it again because I just think it's a good movie. And I think
you can conquer it by realizing I was afraid of that.
Yeah, and I think there's other things that I can show her that I'd like to show her about the special effects, especially in particular in that movie, which is part of the reason it's so good. Not to get too sidetracked with that, but that's another great Blu-ray is the Gate Vestron Video Blu-ray, and I haven't shown her any of the special features on that yet, but we should totally rewatch The Gate. We're due for a Gate rewatch. The Gate 2 coming out reminded me that we're due for it's not as good as The Gate.
Okay.
No, it's interesting, I think she could handle that even more. It's not really scary that much, you know. But anyway, before we go, I'm just going to go through the Night of Living Dead special features on this Criterion Blu-ray. New 4K digital restoration supervised by director George A. Romero, co-screenwriter John A. Russo, sound engineer Gary R. Strainer, and producer Russell W. Strainer. New restoration of the monaural soundtrack supervised by Romero and Gary Strainer and presented uncompressed. Night of Anubis, a never-before-presented work print edit of the film. New program featuring filmmakers Frank Darabont, Guillermo del Toro, and Robert Rodriguez. Never before seen 16mm dailies reel. New program featuring Russo on the commercial and the industrial film production company where key Night of the Living Dead filmmakers got their start. Two audio commentaries from 1994 featuring Romero, Russo, producer Carl Hardman, actor Judith O'Day, and others. Archival interviews with Romero and actors Dwayne Jones and Judith Ridley. New programs about the film's style and score, new interview program about the direction of Ghouls featuring members of the cast and crew, new interviews with Gary Strainer and Russell Strainer, newsreels from 1967, trailer, radio spots, TV spots, essay by critic Stuart Clawins. So a very stacked Criterion Blu-ray, highly recommended, definitely pick it up. It really is a classic. I mean, there's something about the black and white, too. I mean, there weren't that many black and white zombie movies, and there's something that is very impression-leaving about it, you know, that makes it feel it on one level less real and on another level more resonant. I don't know what it is, but it looks great. Definitely worth picking up. Thank you, my dear, for coming on the show.
Matt.
Everybody have a lovely and Blu-ray-filled week. And I will talk to you soon. Bye-bye.